It's to the game of your choice. Tickets and more information at HoustonDynamo.com. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to KPFT Houston.
The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 in Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, and along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, and Dr. Warren Holloman, our engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherlin. I hesitated, but Nicole, I have learned how to pronounce that. And the newest member of our team, Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by bringing you storytellers to tell us their own stories live right here on the radio. These are people who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls with moving narratives, either real experiences or magical folk tales. Over the last 2 weeks, we have heard stories of hardship from journalists who recorded stories from members of our own community who suffered during Hurricane Harvey, and last week from a set of very emotionally difficult stories told by Hank's students. In one case, these stories came from environmental upheaval, and in the other, emotional upheaval. Our guest tonight, Dr. Anais Malpica, will bring us stories from her family about a different and very poignant type of emotional upheaval, their forced migrations after political upheaval, and how that disruption helps unite families across generations and communities. Anaïs's grandfather migrated from Spain to Cuba seeking a new life, and actually not just from Spain, but from the Canary Islands, which gives him a particular perspective on life that Anaïs will tell us about. His daughter, Anaïs's mother, married a man, Anaïs's father, who had come to Cuba because of political persecution in Venezuela. And then together, they had to emigrate to Costa Rica because of political persecution in Cuba. Before Anaïs starts, I have to tell you she is one of my favorite people at work. In addition to being a fabulous storyteller, Anaïs is a pathologist at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. We share experiences as career women and as mothers. Our children graduated from high school in the same year. Now, I'm up on the third floor, and she's on the first floor. And, you know, we do have a saying, what happens on the third floor stays on the first floor, on the third floor, just like Vegas. But every so often I have to go down to the first floor, and I make sure that I take a trip down her hallway and seek her out, because I know that five words past hello, I'm going to be hearing a story, a great story. So greetings, Anaïs. Is this your first time on radio?
Good evening. Thank you, Mary, for having me here, for allowing me to tell the story. This is not my first time on the radio. I have been before in a foreign country, actually in Venezuela, in a city called Valencia, while we were trying to sponsor some educational activities at the university there.
Okay. So I got you second time around, but I'm going to get your life stories. I do remember one time when I was into short filmmaking, and you came and said, do you know anybody who could make a movie? I want to make a movie about my life. And so when I was thinking about a speaker, I said, she's a storyteller, and she's got a life story. Anaïs, quickly, tell us, have you had experiences with KPFT in the past?
Yes. Several years ago, I decided to contribute to this great radio station, KPFT, the Radio for Peace. And as a token of appreciation, I got this beautiful sticker with a dove, a red dove, and I drive this very old Volvo 1995 station wagon, and I was displaying my sticker proudly. And then I realized that every other month I was being stopped by the police when I was trying to cut through Southgate from Bel Air to my house. And it was an inconvenience because many times I was transporting the swords of my children, who at that time were taking fencing lessons. So I was puzzled by the fact that I was periodically stopped by the police. So I made a comment to a friend of mine, Michael Devers, and he said, you know what? Perhaps it's the KPFT sticker, Radio for Peace, that is creating all this trouble for you when you are crossing a neighborhood that is very conservative.
Yes, along with a few swords in the backyard. So the political persecution has followed you here. But I promise you, if you donate again, and I must mention to you and all our listeners out there that we will start our next fund drive in the coming week, I will be a character witness for you, Anais. But now, let's move to learning how political upheaval has affected you since you were born. I know that you consider yourself 60% Cuban and 40% Venezuelan. And I know about the Cuban part because I can come into your office when you're having a Cuban moment and you will even turn to me and say, I am so sorry, Mary, that I can't answer your question yet because I'm having a Cuban moment.
Yeah.
And but you were born in Venezuela, and so you have a story for us that punctuates that point. Can you share that with us?
Sure. I was born in Venezuela in a household that was essentially run by a Cuban mother. My mother was an incredibly strong woman with very strong principles, and it was extremely pragmatical woman. I think that that came from the fact that she was the daughter of an immigrant that had a rough time in Cuba, who eventually made a good amount of money in Cuba, but who had a very rough time to start in the tobacco business. You know, it was not an easy business, especially for a guy coming from the Canary Islands. So my mother was strong. My mother was a very responsible, an excellent mother, but she kept that Cuban culture alive in a way that's the reason why I feel like a Cuban and I react like a Cuban, which many times is a very good thing and sometimes it's a bad thing because we tend to react and we tend to be explosive. But once everything is settled, I think things can go quite well with a Cuban because of the energy and the drive that they bring to any place where they are. My mother was a beauty, a Latin beauty. She was like the Grace Kelly in Havana. She, as I said, she came from a family where the father had migrated from the Canary Islands to Cuba. Her mother was first generation Cuban, born to Canarian parents. So that defines certain characteristics of this individual. They are going to work hard and they are going to go for something. And usually is a better living. They want to live well. They are looking for better opportunities to be in a better place. So that was pretty much her dream, to be in a better place. She had the fortune to come to school in Georgia, in a place called Macon, Georgia. And she got a good education. She went back to Cuba and she worked for a TV network. First, and then for a radio network called La Cadena Azul. Also, she was a model for a coffee brand in Cuba called Café Tupi. And she was just aiming to marry a rich man because, remember, living well was part of the plan. At the time that my mother ran into my father, she was dating a physician who was a resident, and they used in Havana during the late 40s, parties were quite frequent. You know, you had parties Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays. And this guy happened to be on duty, on call, and he could not accompany my mother to one of her parties. And that's the moment where my father happened to run into my mother because he was crashing the party, very well dressed. He made her believe that he was a rich man. So my mother saw this guy with impeccable manners who had a very solid story. He had left Venezuela because he was involved with politics, trying to oust a dictator. So he ended in Cuba, but he managed to present himself quite well. As I said, he was very educated, very properly dressed. So she really believed he was a rich man. They leave in Cuba very shortly after they met because then Batista took over. And all the people that were involved in politics in other Latin American countries had to leave Cuba. So there was essentially this groups of dictators in Latin America that they were friends. So if a person was being prosecuted in a country, had run to another country where a dictator happened to take over the government, those people had to leave. So my father and my mother ended living in Costa Rica for many years. It was a different lifestyle for my mother, who was used to these glamorous nights in Havana. You know, it's funny, here in the States, when people want to portray something glamorous, they talk about Havana nights. Those Havana nights of the 40s and 50s, where people will dress up and essentially enjoy an incredible evening socializing. That was not what she is left in Costa Rica. A country was much more smaller, more provincial. And then my father, who was involved with politics, you know, it was like a serious operation. These individuals are trying to oust a dictator. These are operations that take years. My mother started to get involved in politics now to support the ousting of Batista. As my father was trying to oust the government of Perez Jimenez in Venezuela, my mother, who was just a Grace Kelly in the tropics, decided to do something for her own country. Little she knew that her father's only property was going to be lost through that movement. They spent in Costa Rica 8 years. When the government changed to place in Venezuela, it was a moment of joy, because it was a very long saga to oust a dictator who was extremely cruel. My father lost many of his friends in jail. My father himself had been in jail, and he was supposed to be moving to a camp where essentially people were dying of malaria. The reason why he got out of that was that one of my aunts happened to go and pledge for his life. She went to one of his cousins, somebody that he was not close to anymore, who had married the brother of the dictator, and essentially she begged him. Olivia, who was the name of the cousin, went to her husband and begged him for help to save my father. So that's the reason why my father left Venezuela in asked for political asylum, initially in Cuba, and later on he went to Costa Rica. When they went back, it was a moment of really rejoice, because it was a long period of sacrifice for many. Then my mother realized that my father was not a millionaire. You know, that was the moment of truth. The guy was in politics, had done a beautiful and a steady job trying to help this movement, but he was not rich. He had essentially lied to capture her attention. And things were fine when they were all poor in Costa Rica, because that was the condition of somebody who was under the condition of political asylum in Costa Rica. But once they went to Venezuela, my mother was expecting to see all the properties that he had described that didn't exist. So that was the reason why she many times said, and that was something like, it was a torment for us, the kids, to listen to this statement. She used to say, I didn't come to this country to live like this. So for us as children, you know, we live in a middle-class neighborhood, something like West University here in Houston. She had two maids, and we really didn't understand what she was meaning when she was saying, I didn't come to this country to live like this. Well, if you had been told that you were going to live in a mansion and that you had three farms and you had cattle and you had plantations and you had all these things that really didn't exist, she felt that she had been cheated. So that was one of the things I never understood as a child. But sometimes, and my husband, who has been quite supportive of everything that I have done through the years, my husband is a wonderful man, but he comes from a small farm in Michigan. And sometimes when I pull out one of those grayscale in the tropics tricks and said to him, I didn't come to this country to live like this, he looks at me like, puzzle, what is she talking about? And at this point, I just realized I'm just saying what my mother said. You know, you set your expectations so high. You dream of something that perhaps does not exist. And that's what I do many times. And I see my husband's face these days is the same face that my father had when my mother was making that statement. I didn't come to this country to live like this.
Aha. Now, that's a wonderful story, and I have to say, one can only begin to wonder about the magic of love combined with the life dreams of our mothers. I mean, my own mother married my father. He was a very handsome engineer. My mother had been in a family very impoverished by the Depression, so much so that her own mother, who was widowed, had to ask some of her relatives to help raise the children in the family. And so two of her sisters went to live with relatives, and she and her brother stayed at home with their mother. One reason why I think my mother was always very insecure is when might she be next? And so I think she married a man who had a ranch, only the ranch happened to be in a semi-arid area of Texas. And I think she came down thinking, oh, I'm going to be a rancher's wife. And her expression was a little different in that she tried to imagine that we were living someplace differently, and she would always say to me, we're living in genteel poverty. You may think we're living in poverty, but we're living in genteel poverty. And it took me a long time to figure out what that meant. Okay, you are hearing this story, as you have heard many others, here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And I know that some of y'all are out there on kpft.org live streaming The Modern Way to Go. I am your host, Mary Edgerton. Anais, you had some stories you were telling me about mailing things, and that's another one where you begin to repeat history.
When I was little, you know, and I'm talking about 1964, 1965, there was a very serious shortage of food in Cuba. I was 4 years old, and I was seeing my mother gathering boxes where she was putting items that we were not supposed to be eating at home, because my mother was like a big, big, I will say, health conscientious individual. She was always checking what we were eating. Everything had to be natural, non-processed. The meat could not have been frozen. Everything had to be fresh. We were not allowed to drink sodas, or we were not allowed to eat anything that came from a can. Nothing that could have been processed, okay? So I'm 4 years old, and I'm seeing my mother buying all this span, canned vegetables, canned fruits. Everything was coming in a can. A lot of pasta, a lot of rice, toothpaste, aspirin, medicines, you know, antacid, analgesics. My mother used to gather these huge piles of items, and we were packing boxes. These boxes were taken from the neighborhood in the mountains where we live, all the way to downtown Caracas, you know, and that was a 1 hour drive. We were carrying all these boxes and we were going to Iberia, Spanish airline, the headquarters in Caracas were in downtown Caracas. And we were shipping these boxes to Cuba. But as at that time, there were no diplomatic relationships between Cuba and Venezuela, the boxes had to go from Caracas all the way to Madrid and from the Madrid to Havana. So, as I said, I was 4 years old and I was wondering, wait a second, my mother does not allow us to eat this food, but we are sending this food. So, first question, why are we sending this food that you tell us not to eat? She said, this is going to be a long journey. The food is going to be damaged if we don't send them this canned food. I said, okay. And why such a huge trip? Well, because we don't have diplomatic relationships. So the boxes have to go to Spain and then they have to be sent to Havana. So I used to stare at the map in the Iberia office and said, my gosh, how can it be possible that you are sending boxes across the Caribbean, across the Atlantic, and then those boxes are making it back to the Caribbean? I say, how can it be possible that you just ship food around the world? How come a country does not have food? 53 years later, I'm in Houston, Texas. I collect food. I send food to Venezuela. And I still wonder, how come a country cannot produce the food that is needed by the people who are in that country? So more than 50 years later, I'm still wondering the same. Last Friday, I sent three big boxes to Venezuela. And each time that I put food in those boxes, my heart really cries. Because I still can't understand how food has to be sent from one place to another because the people in that place cannot produce the food that is needed to sustain that country.
I can feel how moved you are by that. Who is left in Venezuela?
My brother, Jose Luis, who does not want to leave the house where we grew up. It's a very emotional thing for him. I compare the situation to what people went through this in Europe during the Second World War, where people didn't want to leave a house because of a piano, because of a garden, because of the memories. That's my brother. He doesn't want to leave a house because of the memories, because what that house meant to my parents. They put a lot of sacrifice to buy that house. That was the house that could please my mother in the best neighborhood that my father could afford. And still, it was not good enough for her, but it was very good for us because it was safe, was beautiful. Nowadays, the neighborhood is still somehow decent. The house is totally run down because it hasn't been kept up in 25 years. So
it's a very difficult situation in Venezuela. And then, unfortunately, we can say, you know, as we heard a couple of weeks ago about Hurricane Harvey, and now we're hearing about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico and across the Caribbean. There are so many places devastated by climate, but Venezuela is one that's been affected so much by political upheaval. I want to thank you again. It is amazing how we find ourselves repeating history. I love your story of how you heard your mother, even though as a child you didn't understand it, say, I didn't leave Cuba to live like this, and how you say it's those are the words that come to you. You know, people repeat things, and then now you find yourself, like your mother, packing up food and sending to your relatives. So I'm going to step out here. Hey, Nicole.
Hey.
Is there anything that you do or say that you recognize is coming from your mother?
Absolutely. When my kids get in trouble, the first thing I say is, I brought you in this world and I'll take you out. But the other thing I tell, especially to my daughter, is that you always can count your true friends on the one hand that you have, and you will not use all of your fingers.
That's a beautiful statement. I try to tell my friends, you know many types of people. You have close friends like family, and then you have friends, and then you have other friends, and then you have acquaintances, and you need to understand the spectrum.
Yes.
That's beautiful. So we have just listened to some wonderful stories, some moving stories. Stories not only connect the storyteller to the generations before and after them, as we have learned, but they connect us across the community. Nicole, can you tell us about some storytelling connections in our community?
Well, of course I can, Mary, but I want to first start off with the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. So just get to their monthly swaps that is held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located 1500 Sunset. Also, you can go to their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. And that's every show since 2008. And it's listed right there under the radio program. Also, for those who don't listen to live radio anymore, there is no excuse for missing our show, because you can listen to us live stream on kpft.org, and we are live right now on Facebook. You can tell us what you're thinking. You can give us program suggestions, ideas, by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise that we will get back to you. And please be sure you like our page on the way out, and tell all of your friends, family, and your enemies too. Also,
time to put on our lipstick, ladies.
Yes, put your lipstick on.
Because we're on Facebook Live.
Yes, put it on. But check out also to our program clips. We do have a YouTube channel, so make sure you check it out. And we don't want to forget about our friends at the mall, that they are at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. And this coming month, the theme is creepy. And in addition to that, the Moth Grand Slam, which was postponed during the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey, has now been rescheduled for November 3rd. And two of our co-hosts will be there, our very own Greg Audell and originator of our show, Dr. Hank Rubicek, along with several of our past guests.
Oh, wow. That's so exciting. That's going to be a great show. So, Hank, are there some of our guests from So What's Your Story who will also be on at the Grand Slam?
There are indeed, Mary. First of all, these stories are wonderful, Anais. You really dug deep for these stories, and I very much appreciate it. And, you know, Nicole, I hate to break this to you, but to say I brought you into this role and I'm going to take you out has been said by moms and dads with unsuccessful results for generations.
But my kids don't know that, so don't say that on the air.
Okay, well, I just did.
Okay, can I just interject?
I was just... Oh, here we go.
I was just...
Peanut stand.
I was just hiking in Utah, and I saw... I did not take my children with me. Way too difficult. But I saw this mother with her young child, and I hear her saying, "Well, if you keep complaining, next time we're going to leave you at home."
Right. I love it. Yeah, the stupid things we say as parents. Honest to God. Yes, we're going to talk about the Grand Slam. Very excited. But, you know, first of all of our shows are not to be missed, Mary. We all know that. But the season to be really jolly is coming up. I love Halloween. We all love Halloween, don't we? And
we do.
On October 18th, we have a special Halloween show. Wait. Oh, my God, I'm sorry. Somebody just walked in and said that. But the Halloween show on October 18th, just reminding everybody, it will not to be missed, just like every show that we do every week. Now, the Grand Slam, Paul Topikian, you know him very well. He was your guest. Magnificent teller is going to be there. Harwood Taylor, who's been on several times. Brad Shear, Lisa Lackner, Kent Keith, Chris Gorman. All of them have been guests. And then there's Donna Edwards, Robert Dempsey. I'm not too familiar with them. And Greg and myself. And I got to tell you, it will be a fun, fun night.
That is going to be a fabulous, fabulous night. So I will just quickly tell you my one Halloween story. I decided to wear my kigu, and if anybody doesn't know what that is, it's a very giant flannel suit that comes in various disguises. And I decided, since I'm a pathologist, and I know Anais will appreciate this, that I should have a skeleton kigu. And they're sort of very wide at the middle, kind of cartoonish, and a little hat hood that comes over your head, and I'm black with a skeleton painted on it. And I was going from Houston to Boston, and I decided to wear the kigu because it's cold in Boston and it wasn't in Houston. And that worked fine for the first part of the weekend. And on the way back, I decided to wear my kigu because it's comfortable. And there was a call for a doctor on board. And I was the only doctor on board. And how would you feel if you needed a doctor on board and your doctor walked up in a skeleton costume? Okay. All right. Okay, Nicole, so what's up for next week here at So What's Your Story?
Well, Mary, Warren is hosting, and he tells me that you two have a show about raising daughters.
Oh, yes, we do. And as always, it will be a lot of fun working with Warren. And speaking of families, but sons in this case, Anais, your stories from the past remind me of a book that you recommended to me, Waiting for Snow in Havana. It is beautifully written, a memoir of a young boy who left Cuba with his older brother as part of Operation Peter Pan, in which children were evacuated from Cuba without their families, without their parents, and place it in foster homes in the U.S. Anais, can you read the opening paragraphs for us?
Sure. This is an amazingly beautiful book. The author is Carlos Ayres. The title, as you said, Waiting for Snow in Havana. The world changed while I slept, and much to my surprise, no one had consulted me. That's how it would always be from that day forward. Of course, that's the way it had been all along. I just didn't know it until that morning. Surprise upon surprise. Some good, some evil. Most somewhere in between. And always without my consent. I was barely 8 years old, and I had spent hours dreaming of childish things, as children do. My father, who vividly remembered his prior incarnation as King Louis XVI of France, probably dreamed of costume balls, mobs, and guillotines. My mother, who had no memory of being Marie Antoinette, could have shared in his dreams. Maybe she dreamed of hibiscus blossoms and fine silk. Maybe she dreamed of angels, as she always encouraged me to do. Sueña con los angelitos, she would say. Dream of little angels. The fact that they were little meant that they were too cute to be fallen angels. Devils can never be cute. The tropical sun knifed through the gaps in the shutters, as always extending in narrow shafts of light above my head, revealing in dark galaxies of swirling dust specks. I stared at the dust as I always wrapped. I don't remember getting out of bed, but I do remember walking into my parents' bedroom. Their shutters were open and the room was flooded with light. As he slid his baggy trousers over his brown wingtip shoes, effortlessly Louis XVI broke the news to me. Batista is gone. He flew out of Havana early this morning. It looks like the rebels have won.
Do you feel a connection with this?
Absolutely. What can I tell you? Being in a situation that you have hurt before, a situation that you have left before. Not only me, one of my sons, Nicholas, my middle son, said once to me, Mom, I just feel that I have gone through so many revolutions and civil wars without even being there. I went through the Spanish Civil War, and I was not born. I went through the Cuban Revolution, and I was not even born. I went through the Venezuelan Revolution, and I was not born. But I just feel that I have gone through all these revolutions myself.
Oh, that's a beautiful statement. That moves me. I'm so glad you introduced me to this book. It's not only the emotions of someone who's gone through this political upheaval, but it is so beautifully written. Have you ever heard the author speak or encountered him?
No, but when I finished this book, I sent him an email, because whenever something is absolutely great or absolutely bad, I have to contact the person responsible for the act. It can be a bad experience. It can be a great experience. So I sent him an email. He replied saying, thank you. When Fidel Castro died, I sent him an email. I say, finally, it happened. I have been hearing about this since I was age 2. And he said, yes, it finally happened, but it will take years for a real change to take place.
Oh, you send chills up my spine. Have you been back to Cuba?
Yes. I went back to see one of my aunts who was still in Cuba. And the last time I was there, like my mother, I said, I will never come back until this change really takes place. It was just too much. It was too abnormal. You know, when you turn a place where people are trying to make a living and all of a sudden they resort to do bad things to survive, it's very hard to see and experience that on a daily basis. And unfortunately, that's what happens when economical systems do not succeed in providing for everybody opportunities to live better, to live a decent life.
So this is Mary Edgerton with Nicole Rocherlin and Tatiana Gago and our guest storyteller, Anais Malpica, with stories about political upheavals and family. And I guess I could say the beginnings of family traditions that comes from this. Anais, your family, of course, had gone through several, I guess, forced migrations, really, from Spain to Cuba, from Cuba to Costa Rica, and then going back to Venezuela, from which there had been a forced migration. And then you were born in Venezuela. So how did you end up in the United States?
That's a great story, actually. One of my best friends, who is currently a chairman in one of the departments at Memorial Sloan Kettering, New York, was the son of a very important businessman who happened to be Cuban. So again, the Cuban connection, okay? So we were one day in this house that was an incredibly beautiful house in Caracas. And I was just waiting for the traffic to die off because I needed to drive to my neighborhood, which is essentially a neighborhood that can get traffic jams like the ones that you see in L.A. to get there because it's somehow remote in the mountains. So he was doing laps in the swimming pool and he said, you know what? My father said that a big change is going to take place in this country, that we are going to need to go away for several years. We are going to need to go away to get the education that we want because the whole system is going to collapse. I said, really? Do you really think that's going to happen? And he said, my father tends to foresee things accurately. Not only because he's smart, but he has studied a lot of history and he has lived big changes through his life. So he can recognize when things are going to happen in a place, and his predictions tend to be accurate. So that's the reason why I ended in the United States. This friend of mine convinced me to come to do my residency here in the States. From there, I met, you know, while I was in residency, I met my husband, who is from Michigan, and who had a big loan that he needed to pay once we completed our studies. So the question was, when we finish, are we going to go back to Venezuela? And he asked me the question, can you guarantee that I will be able of paying my loans? And I said, well, I cannot guarantee you anything because we're going to Venezuela. There are no guarantees there. So his answer was, let me pay my loans, and then we will see. During those years when we were trying to pay his medical school loans, the revolution came to Venezuela.
The changes that had been predicted
by my friend's father, the one who was gifted in business and in political, in social assessments. So I ended doing my residency here, completing my training, my fellowship at MD Anderson. I had married my husband, Andrew, who, as I said already, is a wonderful man from Michigan, who was raised in a small farm. I had our three boys, and here I am.
That's right. One of your boys is the same age as my oldest daughter, because my oldest one was graduating from high school at Duchenne, your son was graduating from St. Thomas, which is their brother's school. And I remember us trading stories about sending them forth into the unknown.
Exactly. That's what it should be called.
Oh, that's an amazing set of stories. There are so many upheavals that your family encountered, and one on the next, and yet they endured. You're still together. You're still close. You still send packages to Venezuela.
Yes, I do.
And you had a little interesting story about sending packages. The last time you were in South America, you were talking about how to send packages to Venezuela.
Well, because you find help in the places where you really don't think you will find help. One of the deals when you are sending packages to Venezuela is to ensure that the package gets delivered. And one of the things that are truly needed there are medications, you know, and I get frequent requests for all sorts of medications, and sometimes I can help, and many times I cannot help because I cannot come up with the medicines that they really need. So over a month ago, I was in Colombia, and again, those are the situations that you are experiencing that are totally different from the people that are around you. Normally, when people go to a medical conference or to any type of business conference, after the conference finishes, people want to unwind and they go to have a nice dinner or they want to have a drink. In my case, I leave the conference to look for medicines. You know, I have to look for a pharmacy where I can just get the medicines that people in Venezuela need to be sent off to Venezuela. So here I am in Cartagena, Colombia, which is a well-known tourist destination. People are pretty much in a party mode. And I'm finishing my conference. I'm trying to get medicines to be sent to Venezuela. And I'm seeing the time of Saturday afternoon. I'm thinking, well, pharmacies are going to be closed. Who's going to drive into a pharmacy? And I see the guy who is providing us with the official support for the Congress. And he said, what do you need? He asked me. I said, well, I need to send medicines to Venezuela. I need to go to a pharmacy. And he said, let me help you. I said, well, it's 6 o'clock. You know, you have to basically wrap this up. He said, well, here's my business card. I will buy the medicines and I will send them to Venezuela. So that's part of the community that you don't know that exists. People who were willing to do something for you. In his particular case, he was very willing to help because he had lived in Venezuela. And he had been helped by many people while he lived in Venezuela.
Oh, that's a wonderful story and a wonderful tribute to humans. You know, we talk up the bad side of humans, and I think under the current political administration, there's a lot of talk of the bad side of humans, but there's actually a great side of humans, which we saw during Hurricane Harvey, Houston Strong, which you talk about in an international sense of people wanting to help people from countries that are suffering. And I've read about Venezuela. I can't say I've experienced that firsthand. Although I was at a wedding, a very good friend of mine, and she seated me at the family table, And the minister who had married her daughter was there, and his wife wasn't there. And although I'm Hispanic, I told you, mm-hmm. Treviño, Olivares are family names, and we descend from conversos who came from Spain, Jews who were persecuted in Spain and went to Mexico. If you saw me right now, I look like an Anglo through yeah. and through. And so this minister also was an Anglo, though spoke Spanish very well. And as I was talking to him, he mentioned that they had been in Venezuela. And he said, you know, he said, one day we would have paper towels, but no toilet paper. And he said, I couldn't understand. It seems to me there's a relationship in the shipping of paper towels and the shipping of toilet paper. And why one week, and then the next week we had toilet paper and no paper towels. And that was actually even in better times. And now it's very serious.
Well, and actually, in trying to send all these things, you know, you get into these riddles, okay? For instance, medications, okay? If you send medication, it can be possible that you lose part of what you're sending. Your package can be open, and some of the boxes can be taken. So part of the shipment makes it, and another portion of your shipment doesn't make it because it's retained. And actually, that's going to be result. You know that, okay? But the situation becomes quite Kafkian when you don't know that you are getting involved in something like smuggling, okay? 2 years ago, my brother was going to have a procedure, and I needed to be there. So it's extremely expensive to take a direct flight to Caracas right now, because essentially the airlines don't know when they're going to lose the plane. You know, it can be that all of a sudden this plane doesn't leave Caracas, and the airline is losing a plane right there. So a more economical way to get to Caracas is going through another city. So I'm flying from Mexico City to Caracas. And then you see basically a group of Venezuelans showing up with all sorts of bags, you know, things that have been checked in, but additional stuff. Because, you know, you have to carry a lot because there is a lot of need there. So you're carrying everything. My brother was going to be in the hospital, so I was like carrying gauze, I was carrying disinfectant, I was carrying toilet paper. So one of the Venezuelans asked me, what are you bringing? You know, this is another passenger. I said, well, I'm bringing toilet paper. How many rolls? 12, she said to me. Do you know that they can arrest you because you're smuggling toilet paper? And all of a sudden you're like, what? Well, yes, you can be labeled a smuggler. And now you're in trouble. And now you're panicking on a plane to Caracas. Am I going to be accused of being a smuggler because I'm bringing toilet paper, and I need a toilet paper because I don't know how many days this guy is going to be in the hospital. And if there is something that we cannot miss, really, is toilet paper. So I landed in Caracas, and I was totally terrified. I'm thinking, this is going to be it, being arrested because I'm a smuggler of toilet paper. Then she looked at me. I was just like about to die. She said, okay, maybe we get lucky, because these people look rather sleepy. Maybe they will not charge you with anything. Let's see if we can get through without getting in trouble. And thank God we did. But I tell you, when we pass, when we clear costume, I said, this is absolutely ridiculous that I panic because I was carrying 12 rolls of toilet paper.
Okay, I know I told several of our colleagues at work to listen to this, so you may be hearing, you may be signs, hey, there's the toilet paper smuggler. So I'm making light of something that really is very serious. And you know, you talked about medicines a little while ago, and I'll just say, as a pathologist, I have never obtained a Drug Enforcement Agency license to prescribe the protected yes. medications, mm-hmm. because I thought somebody's going to say, well, who are you prescribing to, you know, the dead patients on the autopsy table? No. And but I can prescribe the odd antibiotic. But every so often somebody will come to me and ask, and my line is, are you kidding? The DEA would be on me like a duck on a June bug. Okay. Oh, okay. I have to credit Hank with this. Okay. So, say again, did you know that you can be arrested? Did you know that you can be arrested? Say, let's ask the question. And I'm going to give you Hank's answer, although it's going to be beeped out.
Do you know you can be arrested for smuggling?
Okay. Well, and I've been pretty good. Nicole, right, you have never had to beat me out in the past, right?
Never, but I dumped it, so you're good.
Anais, how do your stories come together? If you had a tip for a storyteller, I mean, like I say, I come down to your office with time to spend because I know I'm going to run into Anais. I want to hear the story. 5 words into saying, hello, Anais, can you help me with this? We're going to be launched in a story. Or like when I came down to the office the other day, it was, I'm having a Cuban moment. You're just going to have to wait. Do you have a tip for a storyteller? How do you bring your stories together?
I think, and I have to actually cite Tom Ford on this one. You know, I think I just think constantly in cinematographic mode. You know, I'm always playing like a movie in my head. So I see things, I hear things, and then I'm thinking in those terms, but also I think it's because I truly interact with life. I pay attention to every single human being that is around me. I pay attention to the environment. I pay attention to how things are set, how things look. I look at the way that things are arranged. Do they make sense? Do I see a pattern? So I'm constantly seeing. It's like my eyes are constantly recording, and I'm recording information, voices, words, patterns, actions. And then is when the story comes alive, because then it's been put together like a movie.
Okay, that's actually a great point, is to begin to absorb everything and see the pattern in it and giving it that story, that beginning, middle, and end that we talk about, so that it becomes the movie. That's actually a nice one. And really quickly, was there a storyteller in your family? Because you tell stories, as I think you were telling stories when you were 2 and 3 years old, when you first learned to talk, that your first 3-word sentences were a story. So was there a storyteller in your family?
My mother.
Oh.
My mother, as you know, as you said already, we come from this long lineage of political upheaval. When my mother was little, there was a civil war in Cuba. Okay? So actually, there was a very rough period in the 30s. So she was sent off to a farm. And there, they have access to nothing. No radio. Obviously, there was no TV. It was in the 30s, rural Cuba. So the way that they entertained themselves was telling stories. Also, people in the Canary Islands, because they are so far away. They are so far away from Spain. They are close to Africa, but they are not considered Africans. They are part of Spain. They don't have the common language with Northern Africa. They are good storytellers. They are obviously engaged with each other. They need to tell a story to entertain themselves.
So her father must have been a storyteller.
So they had to put the stories together, to keep the traditions together, the memories together. So they were very good storytellers too.
And I love to emphasize how stories are the oral tradition, the history of our families, in the way that the oral tradition of storytelling used to be the history of the land, the history of the culture. that's now part of the written word. But histories of our families are still an oral tradition. Okay, last thing, you want to say goodnight to somebody special in Radioland?
Well, I would like, now I sound like the Venezuelan boxers. I want to say goodnight to my family. I want to say really goodnight to my family, to my husband Andrew, to my sons Alexander, Nicholas, and Sebastian. I would like to say goodnight to our trainees at MD Anderson, because today they were all hearing that I was going to be here at KPFT Radio for Peace.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yes, that was very exciting. Actually, I told several people on my floor, you gotta listen. So I think our night is coming to an end for us on So What's Your Story? But don't move that dial, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. So, and I have to tell you, so mother to mother, okay, in my case, it was teaching my kids rock music. Did you teach your kids classic music from either classical? And actually, you know what? So being Hispanic and having grown up on the border, mine know everything. They know mariachi music. They know I had a Mexican kind of slash rock slash mariachi band play at my 50th birthday. And then they know the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, etc. And so, it, of course, they know Malagueña Sarrosa, and they know La Paloma. You know, so do your children know music across that spectrum?
Well, it's kind of interesting what happened in my family. As I'm like the mother of my children, but I'm the daughter of my mother, I wanted them to learn piano. Oh. So I bought a piano, and two of them were forced to take piano lessons. Of course, they hate it. And they have a very ample taste when it comes to music. The youngest one knows a lot about opera and enjoys opera very much. And the other ones just listen to the music of the youth.
Okay. Well, okay. So back to where we were on the music scene. Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turn it in for the night or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget, and I think it has a lot of meaning after the stories you've heard tonight, that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Thank you, Mary.
Come and enjoy a night full of songs, guitars, and gypsy jazz. A delicious night full of acoustic sounds and jazz rhythms like Dixieland jazz, Musette, and Bossa. There will be composers and songwriters such as Lourdes Jimenez, Nico Diaz, Guillermo Gutierrez, and a gypsy jazz band known as Bayou City Swing. All of this taking place on Saturday, October 14th. At 6 in the evening in La Cámara de Empresarios Latinos de Houston, located at 7047 Harrisburg Boulevard. Visit us for more information at our Facebook page, KPFT Son Pacifica. That's KPFT S-O-N Pacifica. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
KPFT Houston has a fun drive coming up soon, and we need your help to make it a success. Each fund drive, volunteers answer phones and take the vital pledges from listeners that fund KPFT operations throughout the year. Volunteer efforts make a difference, and together, we'll make this drive fun and successful. We are utilizing a new system for pledge taking, so both new and seasoned phone volunteers are asked to sign up for training. Just call the membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314, to schedule your training date and time. After your training, visit kpft.org and click the Sign Up Genius link to sign up for your phone volunteer shift. If you are part of an organization providing three or more volunteers for a pledge drive phone shift, we'll thank your organization on air.